Zero both sides.
All right.
So we started the second perek yesterday. Let's just go over what we did yesterday in the Mishnah at the beginning of the second perek. Kohen Gadol, Don v'Donin Oso. And we pointed out here that there's a great chiddush in the Mishnah. A Kohen Gadol might be below his dignity to testify in front of a court, but nevertheless, the Mishnah establishes that he's obligated to testify. He doesn't have an exemption under the rule of what's called, and we discussed this in the Iyun Shir at great length, there's a rule that goes, Zaken v'eino l'fi chvodo, and the Gemara establishes above Metziah that if it's below someone's dignity, we don't impose upon him, the Torah doesn't obligate him to return an Aveda. He doesn't have to schlep someone's animal, you know, over his shoulders if it's below his dignity. He's a zaken. And the Gemara thinks that that should apply equally well to the case of a Kohen Gadol as far as Eidus is concerned. Especially, I mean, just to make it even more dramatic, let's say the Kohen Gadol is a great scholar as well. And the Dayanim sitting on the Beis Din are, they're regular citizens. They're not great scholars. And they're going to interrogate him when he comes to testify. So that should come under the principle of Zaken Veinu L'Chvifodo. So the Gemara is going to have to iron this out. V'Donin Oso. And not only that, if, let's say, somebody sues him or somebody accuses him of a crime, now he's on trial and he's not above the law. The Gemara is going to explain why the Mishnah had to mention this. What was the Habamina that he would be beyond the law, so to speak, because this whole mission is to contrast Kohen Gadol with Melech, and in Melech we're going to see that you cannot put the Melech up for trial. Okay, no matter what the AG will say. Okay, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so it says the following: Meid u'meidin oso, he can judge, he can be an aid. He can be judged, he can be testified against if somebody testifies against him. And this is the status of the Kohen Gadol. Now, when does the Kohen Gadol become unique? In what context? That's with regard to the laws of Yibum. And the reason for this is because a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry an Almona. A regular Kohen is allowed to marry an Almona. So if, let's say, the Kohen Gadol's brother dies and leaves no children, so in that case, he, the Kohen Gadol, could be Miyabim, his brother's wife. We'll see about that soon. But let's say, for example, in a case... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me correct what I just said. He cannot be Miyabim, his brother's wife, because she's an Almona. And he's not allowed to marry an Almona. What he could do for his brother's wife is he could do Chalitza. Now here also there's a bit of a Chiddush here, and that is that when the Kohen Gadol's sister-in-law, the widow, does Chalitza, she actually has to spit in front of him. And there's a whole Kriyas HaParsha in which she says that this person refused to marry her and so forth. And that is a little bit it's a little bit disgracing to the Kohen Gadol. But nevertheless, the Mishnah says, Choletz. So he frees his sister-in-law and allows her to marry anyone by doing Chalitza. And he cannot marry her, he cannot be Miyabim her because she's an Almona. And a Kohen Gadol has to marry a Besula. Now what happens if the Kohen Gadol himself dies childless and he leaves his wife behind? Is Choltzin li'ishto u'miyabmin es ishto. Then here the regular rules of Chalitza and Yibum fall into place, and they apply equally to a Kohen Gadol as they would to anyone else. And if he left a brother, then his brother is allowed to marry an Almona because his brother is not the Kohen Gadol. So therefore he could be Miyabim, the Kohen Gadol's wife. The other alternative is he can give her Chalitza. That's fine. So he has no way of being miyabim his sister-in-law because she's an almona. Now, from this point, almost until the end of the Mishnah, until the Mishnah swings back to Melech, we're going to talk about the laws of Avelus. Now, within the context of the laws of Avelus, we have the following issues. Number one, the Kohen Gadol has seven relatives. If any of those seven relatives die, then he's obligated in Avelus. And what that means is that he would be part, normally if he wasn't the Kohen Gadol, he would be part of the funeral procession to bury one of his close relatives. For example, the psukim at the beginning of Parshas Emor tell us that a Kohen, a regular Kohen, although he's enjoined from being metami to a mess, but in the case of one of his seven relatives, then he is metami to a mess. But the Kohen Gadol, because of a special pasuk, is enjoined from being metame even to one of his close relatives. So now he is an avel, but he cannot participate in the funeral procession because he's carrying the mess, and he's not allowed to contract tumah even for the sake of his close relatives. So now the question is the following. Okay, he cannot actually come in contact with the dead, with one of his close relatives, but nevertheless, can he participate in some sense, or some way from a distance at least, in the funeral procession? And that's called Yotzei Achar HaMita. So the Mita means the coffin, and Yotzei Achar HaMita means to escort the coffin, without touching it necessarily, till the interment. And to our surprise, the Mishnah tells us that Eini Yotzei Achar HaMita, as if to say, he's not allowed to participate at all in any shape or form in the procession to escort the mess, even though again he's not coming in contact with neither with the mess nor with the mita. And this is all the shita of Rabbi Meir. Now, you may think that Rabbi Meir is being harsh, unduly harsh on the Kohen Gadol, but as we'll soon see, quite the contrary. The opposite is true. Rabbi Meir is going to be the one in our Mishnah who's going to be most lenient with regard to the Kohen Gadol. And what does that mean? Eini Yotzei Achar HaMita means he's not allowed to be in the first line of those who are escorting the mess to its interment. Ella, but he could in some shape or form, we're going to allow him to participate in Levayas HaMess, in escorting the dead, and within what framework, what structure, is Hein Nichnasim Vehu Nigla, Hein Niglim Vehu Nichnas. So let's try to understand what's going on. What's going to happen here is we're going to play what I call a kind of a hide and seek. And that means the following. Those who are in the front line and they're escorting the dead, they are nichnasim. What it means is they enter into, let's say, a street. And once they enter into a street, they're no longer visible. So imagine if you have like a little bit of a maze. So once the malavim make a turn and they vacate one particular street and enter into another street, so that's called Hein Nichnasim. Hein Nichnasim means they entered into the second street, which means they are now out of eyesight. Meaning those who are going on the main road will no longer see that entourage because they've already turned into a side street. That's called Nichnasim. And Nelamim Me'enov. Notice at this point the Kohen Gadol who's lagging behind, he can no longer see them. At that point, who nigla? Rabbi Meir at that point allows him to enter into that street that was just vacated. Because even as he enters into the street, he is at such a distance from the mita that he can't even see the malavim with his eyes, because they've already entered into a different street. Hey niglim. Now, at some point, he continues up that street and he meets up with the entourage. So now niglim. Now he can see them. At that point, who nichse? He's not allowed to be. He's not allowed to be in any range in which he could see. He could see the entourage. So he's always in a situation where, although he's following the mita, and we'll see how far he can go, but he's never close enough to actually see the entourage of the malavim. And v'yotze imahem ad pesach shar ha'ir. He's allowed to continue in this way. You know, they go into one street, and they vacate the first one. He goes into the one that they vacated. They vacate the second street. He goes into the second street, and this can continue until the point of ad pesach shar ha'ir. Now, what does this mean? Ad pesach shar ha'ir. Once they get out of the city streets, now anyone, including the Kohen Gadol, if he continues out of the Shar Ha'ir, would be able to see them. And again, what we require here is that they should be totally out of sight. So once he enters, or shall we say, once the entourage exits the city gates, they're now in an open field, so to speak. And at this point, the Kohen Gadol has to drop out, because if he exits through that same portal, then he will be in eyes view of the entourage. And that he's not allowed to do. So in the footnote, he quotes Rabbi Yonah's son, one of the Rishonim in the Shittim Gubetzes. He says, Shemisham v'yelech ha'mokom pasuach v'enam nichnasim ov. Nichnasim, we said, means that they are out of sight. They're no longer... and therefore he has to drop out. He has to now turn around and go back home. Now, what is it about this whole entourage, this whole funeral procession, that prohibits the Kohen Gadol from joining the procession? He's always got to be lagging behind in such a way that he's not even capable of seeing the malav. So the answer to that question will become more clear when we see Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is even more machmir. Rabbi Yehuda says, "Eni yotzei min hamikdash." He shouldn't at all join the procession, not even by dropping back to the far distant pathway or street. Mishum shenemar, because the pasuk says, "Min hamikdash lo yetsei." So, at the beginning of Parshas Emor, the Torah says, "Min hamikdash lo yetsei." The way Rabbi Yehuda understands min ha-migdash lo yetze, it doesn't mean that he can never leave the migdash. Obviously, the Kohen Gadol leaves the migdash, but it means he shouldn't leave the Beis HaMigdash for the purpose of levi ames, of escorting the dead. He's completely excluded, totally, no matter how far away he is from the mess, from escorting the mita. Now, Rabbi Meir would also have to interpret this pasuk. What does it mean, eni yotzei min hamikdash? Rabbi Meir apparently understood that eni yotzei min hamikdash is only telling me that he should be very careful, and he should step back a little bit and not take an active role in the front line, so to speak, of the escort. What is this whole thing all about? So I just want to tell you that according to a very significant school of Rishonim, this law, which has a particular goal, and that is to make sure, to guarantee that the Kohen Gadol does not come in contact with the dead or with the mita, is what we call a gzera shegozra haTorah. It's a doraisa halacha. In other words, normally, when you set a fence and you separate a person from an avera, that's a rabbinic enactment. As the Torah says, first mission of it says, Asus Yagla Torah. So if we're afraid that the Kohen Gadol might get so emotional that he'll almost inadvertently come in contact with the dead, so then we should institute Gzeira. But this is different. Why? Because according to this school of thought, the Rishonim, since the Gemara is going to base this whole Mishnah on a pasuk, Min HaMikdash Lo Yetzeh, that means it's a Doraisa Halach. The Torah is telling him not to participate in the escort lest he come in contact with the dead. He might get so emotional, frenzied and anguished that he just wants to grab onto the mita. It's like people want to give their last, you know, last goodbyes. And this is a phenomenal enterprise here, a new concept in halacha. I'm going to try to prove that it's not so new. There are precedents, but gzeira shegazra Torah. Usually, when we institute a gzeira, and as soon as you hear the word gzeira, by sheer association, you're dealing with the drabbanan. Here we're dealing with the doraisa according to this sheet of Rishonim. Many other Rishonim reject this, and the whole pasuk is just an asmachta, but if you take this pasuk literally, we're dealing with the doraisa. So Berzon wants to add one little point. There is a precedent for this concept of gzeira shegazra Torah. And that is in two sources that I know of. I'm sure there are many more. One is the Iser Yichud, that a man is not allowed to be alone with a woman who's an erva. And according to some Rishonim, that's a Doraisa halacha. Again, you may not be familiar with this because most people on the street would say that Iser Yichud is only Drabbanon, but I have a whole essay on this to prove that a number of Rishonim hold that Yichud is Doraisa, because if he's alone with her, he might come to have a relationship with her. So that's again a Gzera Doraisa. Then we have Tosfos at the beginning of Psachim, who speaks about the relationship between Bal Yirah, Bal Yimotzeh, and the Iser Achilas Chometz. The Torah says that if you eat chametz on Pesach, you chayv kares. But then the Torah says, you don't even have chametz in your possession. So if you learn Tosfos carefully, it sounds like Tosfos is saying that once the Torah was so machmir and imposed an Iser kares b'achilas Pesach, the Torah went one step further and it was afraid that if you'll have chametz around, you might come to eat it. So the Torah says, don't keep chametz anywhere in your possession. And I don't know if you've ever heard of a collection of brises called Ovis de Rabbi Nosson. So in Ovis de Rabbi Nosson, it says, Gzera Shegazra Torah Livarea Ketzad. Where do we find the Gzera Shegazra Torah? And if I'm not mistaken, the brisa quotes that case of Bal Yirah Bal Yimotzeh. Which would mean that this enterprise, which you call a gzera or a siag, is not always, by definition, a rabbinic enactment. It could be that sometimes the Torah itself sets up one Iser, that's the primary focus, and then the Torah tells you don't even go near it because you might come to violate
that. It's just a straightforward love.
Obviously, but not for the purpose of my shia. Understand what I'm saying? Okay. So when Avraham Rav Nosson says Gzeira Shegazra Torah Lidvareh, that's a lashon of Tanoim, not Berzon. You see that brisa in Avraham Rav Nosson understood, and it does seem to be implied by Tosfos that the Torah itself makes a Gzeira. All right. Now we're going to turn around the situation of Avelus. It's not that the Kohen Gadol lost one of his relatives, but somebody else lost one of his relatives.
He's making a shiva call.
I'm sorry. Just one second. I think I made a mistake here. Let me just get this again. I'm sorry. Again, the first thing. No. Scratch what I just said. There's no problem with the Kohen Gadol making a shiva call. No. We're talking about a case where the Kohen Gadol lost one of his relatives. Okay, so until now, we've been discussing the obligation of the living towards the dead. And that is the mitzvah of Levi Sames. And where does the Kohen Gadol fit into this when he is the living and he's obligated L'chora in Kavod HaMes, how could he fulfill that obligation towards his sister or whoever died if the Torah says Min HaMikdash Lo Yetzei? Now we're going to talk about some other element. What is the obligation in the aftermath of this death of the living towards the living? What do I mean, the living towards the living? Correct. The mitzvah of Nichum Avelim. Excellent. So we have now the Kohen Gadol lost one of his relatives. He's an Avelus. As far as obligation of Kavod towards the dead, that was severely curtailed. He couldn't bury the dead. He might not even be allowed to participate in the funeral procession, or even if so, at a distance. But now we're talking about the living. And after the dead is buried, at this point the obligation on the living is no longer towards the deceased. They've already fulfilled that. They will malava the mess, they bury the mess, but now they've turned their back the other way. And now they have a chiyu vis-a-vis the living. Who are the living? The avelim. And that's called nicham avelim. So now the Kohen Gadol is in a situation where he's an avel, and the people have an obligation towards the Kohen Gadol, who's an Ovel, to be Menachem the Ovel. Now, generally speaking, the Nichum Avelim can be, shall we say, broken down into three parts. The first part is what's called the Shura, which means that immediately after the Kvura, the people line up, single file, and one by one, the Menachem the Avelim. Then after that, when the Avel enters into his house, there's a second stage which is called Sudas Havra, which means that the people have to bring a meal for the Avelim, and it could be that the people who bring the meal have to eat the meal together with the Avel. It's a kind of symbolic identification with the Avel. We're not leaving you alone, we're with you, we're going to feed you. It might also have to do with the fact that the Ovel is not going to feed himself. He's just so, you know, beside himself. And then finally we get to the third stage, which is Nichum Bepeh, meaning that we've already passed the Sudas Havra, the Avelim are sitting Shiva, and now the Menachemim have to formulate a certain verse, in order to be Menachem the Avelim. So let's see what happens if the Kohen Gadol is the Avel. How many of these dinim, of these three dinim, will be impacted by changed by the fact that it's the Kohen Gadol himself? Okay, fine. Oh, so one second. So again, what are we talking about now? We're talking about the people being Menachem him. Okay, so that's going to be later on in the Mishnah. That's who misnachem me'acherim. Okay. Now, kishahu menachem acherim. Oh, so this is the case I told you before. Not that the Kohen Gadol lost one of his relatives, but rather somebody else lost a relative, and now he, the Kohen Gadol, is obligated to the mitzvah of nichum avelim, and is what's called a shura. Correct? So everybody lines up after the funeral after the burial has completed, and the single file passed by the Ovel to be Menachem. So you would, you know, if we didn't have our Mishnah, the Kohen Gadol would also be part of that single file, and he just passes by the Ovel and he's Menachem. So here's where the Mishnah changes it. And he says the following. Derech, the right way to do it is that kol ha'am ovrim bazecher zeh, every member of the community will file past the avel. That's not the way we do it, by the way, but that's how they did it at the time of the Mishnah. But it's not appropriate. It's not reflective of the dignity of the Kohen Gadol that he should be on this line, on this queue, like everyone else, and pass by single file. So how do we do this? We want to flank him on both sides. Have you ever seen this? Like a Rebbe, a Chassidish Rebbe, he'll have one person on the right side, another person on the left side, he'll be in the middle. If you'll ever see the video of the Chofetz Chaim, 6 seconds, you'll see the Chofetz Chaim at the Knesset Agdol. Have you ever seen that video? No? You have to see it.
It's incredible,
man. Yeah, it's incredible. So you'll see that a giant...
You get on YouTube.
A giant in Torah will be flanked on two sides. So the Mishnah establishes that the Kohen Gadol, when he's filing by, he should be flanked on two sides. On one side is the Memunah, and on the other side is the people themselves. And he, the Kohen Gadol, is in the middle. HaMemunah, that's what's called the Skan Kohen Gadol. He's the second in command. That might mean that if the Kohen Gadol himself contracts tumah, then he, the Skan Kohen, will step into his shoes on a temporary basis to fill in for him. So he's the substitute. This is the Skan Kohen that we take out of the bullpen, so to speak.
Understood.
Let me just get through the pshat, and then Osha, you'll tell me. But I just want to just first read the words. The Mimuna, the Skan Kohenim, Mimatzo means he puts him between him, meaning between the Mimuna, Beino Levena Am. So Mimatzo means wedged. The Mimuna is in charge of wedging the Kohen Gadol, meaning putting him in the middle between himself and the Am, so that he should be flanked on both sides. In other words, let's say the Mimuna will be on his right side, and the people will be on the left side. Now, let's try to envision this. Let's say, for example, this is the Avil. Here's the Avil standing. And what we're going to have here is the following. The people are going to flank by, are going to file by. And let's say, now there are two ways you can understand this. Right? It could be that the people are going in this direction, or it could be they're going in this direction. So I think what's happening is that, let's say, the people are going in this direction, which means that the Avel is on the right, and they're filing by. So you could imagine that the Kohen Gadol will file by as well. No, we need that the Skan, so now this becomes the Kohen Gadol. The Skan is over here, to the right of the Kohen Gadol, and... Just 1 second. Maybe it makes more sense if we go in this direction. Give me a second. If we go in this direction, they're passing by the Avel. Yeah, Lechora could go in both ways. It could either mean that they are flanking him here on the right and the left. In other words, what we're doing is, in a sense, as the line of the people are going by the Avel, we are going to allow the Kohen Gadol to go between the people and the Ovel, so he could be Menachem the Ovel, but he has to be flanked on the right by the Skan Kohen Gadol. And if we do it this way, I think you could come to pretty much the same conclusion. If the Ovel is here, then the people are filing by here in this direction, and before they actually file by in immediate proximity to the Ovel, the Kohen Gadol is going to go by. See, if they allow the Kohen Gadol to go first, then it makes sense. But the only problem is my logistic problem is that once the Kohen Gadol passes the Avil and he's being flanked on the left by the people, how do they get a chance to be Menachem Avil unless they retrace their steps? I don't know if that's going to happen. Let's just see if this would solve the problem. Again, if they're going this way, so the people are over here. If they're going this way, the people are over here. Yeah, in both cases, if the people are on the left of the Kohen Gadol, then how do they get access to the Avil? They're being separated from the Avil by number one, the Skan Kohen Gadol, who's to the right of the Avil, and by the Kohen Gadol himself, who's still to the right of the people. So everybody's here. You know, whether it's the Skan or the Kohen Gadol himself, both are wedging themselves between the people and the Avil. So I'm not exactly sure how they can fulfill that. You know, on the one hand, they have to fulfill their mitzvah of covered Kohen Gadol, and therefore they have to flank the Kohen Gadol, in this case, on the left. But if that be the case, that they're on the outer periphery of the circle around the Avil, and how are they going to be Mekayim, the mitzvah of Nichum Avelu. So that's my logistical problem. Let me see if we go through this. Okay, so let's go through the... So the Derech. Derech means the right way of the Kohen Gadol fulfilling the mitzvah of Nichum Avelu is the following. Hanemune, just 1 second, I skipped something. Kol ha'am ovrim b'zachar zeh. Ah, so they've already passed. Maybe they've already passed. The Omrim, and they will now be Menachem the Ovel. Ve'hamemune mematzo beino levena am. He writes here, Hamemune omeid biyamino, biyamino shel kohen gadol, v'chol ha'am mismolo shel kohen gadol, nimsa shakohen gadol be'emtza. So how do they get a chance to... Are they backtracking? And I don't have the logistics here so well.
Well, they're going in the other direction. Instead of going the direction you have them going, they're going the opposite direction, and then exactly.
Oh, you mean they're facing the Kohen Gadol? Is that what you're saying? The Kohen Gadol's face is looking towards the Yam?
If they were going in this direction, now
let's start from scratch. Here's the oval. Okay, here's the oval.
And here's the Olam is coming this direction. Now the Kohen Gadol is on their left.
Yeah, but...
But he says the Kohen Gadol is on the right. That's my
right.
Problem.
I mean, on the right.
On the right.
They're on the left. They're on the left of the Kohen Gadol.
He's in the middle.
He's here.
And then
the Kohen Gadol is here?
Yeah. The Kohen Gadol is here, the Mamun is here.
So how is the Kohen Gadol going to be Menachem the Ovel? I don't know.
Well,
the logistical problem.
How is he going to be Menachem the Ovel if the Mamun is there too? Either way.
Yes, yeah, so how does that happen? You know, I don't understand how this week about Balaam is going to... Okay. So the basic idea we have that the Kohen Gadol in this communal... enterprise of Nichum Avelim has to be flanked on the right and the left.
Unless they go this way. Right. They go right at the oven. Maybe then they split off. What about that? Go directly onto the oven. If the oven sits here and the Kohen Gadol's in the middle and the arm here and the Mamuna here, and then they come and then they go. They see him. They go up to him directly and then they go on the other side.
So the Kohen Gadol is here, and the people are on the left,
and the Mamun is on the right. And the Kohen Gadol goes directly to Nichum Avelim.
And then the Kohen Gadol continues beyond, and now the Mamuna Kavima. Yeah. It's only after the Kohen Gadol passes. And that's not the way he has it here. He says that, Kolam over Bazachar Zeh.
Yeah.
And he adds the words, V'Omer Lehem Tinachemenu.
Right. Okay.
Tisnachomu, which means they are Menachem Avil.
Yeah.
And then the Kohen Gadol passes by, flanked on the right and the left. I'm not sure if they've already been Menachem, they would. I think they would have to go backwards, if I'm not mistaken. Which is not terrible. I'm not. Let me just see. He has a footnote here.
That's how I would do it.
Ah, oh, he says that we should wait till we see the Sugya Daf Yutes. That's what he says. Maybe we'll get clarity on Daf Yutes. Okay, now we have the opposite case. Now, the Kohen Gadol is the Avel. That was what I discussed before. Ve'hu misnachem me'acherim, and they're coming to be menachem him. So now we have a formula for Nichum Avelim. Is kol ha'om omrim lo anu kaparoscha. As before, what we said was that Nichum Avelim is tisnechamu, or we have a longer formulation, but I think even to this day the Sfaradim say tisnechamu. But now the whole formula changes and it becomes anu kaparoscha. This is reminiscent of Avelus Nebuch for one of the parents who died. For the first year you say Hareni Kaparis Mishkova, that's Gemara in Masechta Kiddushin. It means that anything that any chashom evil that should befall you, let us be the Kapara Hindul, let us be the replacement, the substitute, so that all this evil will befall us rather than you. So Banu Tiskaper. Normally Kapara has to come about through a person's own suffering, but in this case we're asking that we, the people, should suffer as a kapara for the Kohen Gadol. I mean, it's an amazing chiddush over here that that a punishment could be deflated and a kapara could be achieved as if that person... This could be, by the way, a little bit of a raya to the concept that a tzaddik might suffer if he accepts upon himself what's called Yisur B'Avah. He might suffer on behalf of the entire Klal Yisrael. So that you see that Reuven could suffer and Shimon gains the kapara. If Reuven takes it upon himself to generate a kapara for someone else, for Shimon, even though he himself, Reuven, is going to receive the blows, so to speak. Now the Mishnah says that he, the Kohen Gadol, should respond. What is his response? We've never found a response to Nichum Avelim on the part of the Ovel. Maybe he nods his head. But who Omer Lehem Tisbarchu Min Hashomayim? May you be blessed from heaven. I guess, in a sense, he has to repay them for out of a sense of gratitude for what they're doing on his behalf. They're accepting. They're declaring that they're willing to receive the punishment as a kapar for him. He has to give them some sort of quid pro quo. You know, he's not going to take out a checkbook and give them a donation. So instead, he gives them a bracha min hashamayim. Now, all this is going on during the whole procedure of Nichum Avelim. But if you remember, between the first and the third, between the Shura that takes place at the Beis HaKvaros, and then there's the Nichum Avelim, and then there's the Nichum Avelim during Shiva, in the middle there's something called Sudas Havra. Ukshemavrin also, so the Kohen Gadol is in Avel, he just came back from burying the dead. Again, did he come back? I don't know. According to Rabbi Yehuda, he never went. But at least according to Rabbi Meir, he went and now he came back. So the first meal that he eats after the kvura is called the Suda Savra. And they have to feed him the Suda Savra. Is Kol Ha'am Misubim Al Ha'aretz. Behu Mesiv Al Ha'safsa. In other words, in a normal case of Suda Savra, they all sit on the same level, or the opposite might be true. Maybe the people are on a higher level than the Ovel because he's sitting on a low bench. But in the case of the Kohen Gadol's in Ovel, then when they bring him the Suda Savra, they're so mitztayer, they're in such an intense, they identify or commensurate with his suffering to such an extent that they are also participating in the Avelus. They're not just big shots that are bringing the Suda, with a piece of chicken, roast chicken and some baked potatoes, but they also are in Avelus. And therefore they sit on the ground. Now why are they sitting on the ground? Who makes it al safso? Right, he's in Avel, he sits on a low bench, but they're even lower than him. So that's already covered to the Kohen Gadol. So we have a combination here of changing the very nature of the Nichum, meaning the formula for Nichum, and that means in a more profound sense that they, the people, are willing to take upon themselves the Kapara for on behalf of the Kohen Gadol. And number two, we have an actual, if you could call it a Kiyum Avelus, in which the people are sitting like Avelim on the floor. They're identifying, empathizing with his Avelus, and at the same time, while empathizing with his Avelus, they're Makai in the midst of Kibbut. So they get a double Kiyum. On the one hand, they have a Kiyum of Avelus. They also are grieving over the loss that the Kohen Gadol sustained with the death of one of his relatives, and at the same time, they are Makai in the mitzvah of kavod to the Kohen Gadol. So it seems that the minhag was, back in the day of the Mishnah at least, that when you fed the Ovel, that Suda Savra, that first Suda, you would join him in the Suda. In the case of a Kohen Gadol, it's more than just joining him in the Suda to make him feel that he's not alone, but it's actually a participation in Avelus that expresses itself in Yeshiva Al-Gabi Karka. Ad Kan Kohen Gadol. Now the last part of the Mishnah is the Melech. Okay. There's a footnote here about the Memunah. Who exactly is the Memunah? So he writes in the name of the Rambam, Memanim Kohen Echad Sheyeh LeKohen Gadol. He, the Memunah, will be the Kohen Gadol in event that the Kohen Gadol can't function as the Kohen Gadol. And he's called a skan in the language of the Rambam. So he has two names. He's the Memunah because he's been appointed, and he's the skan because he's the replacement Kohen Gadol in event that the Kohen Gadol cannot serve as the Kohen Gadol. The Rambam adds, V'yia omeid liyamin Kohen Gadol tamid. Wow, interesting. We have a case where the Kohen Gadol is filing past the Ovel to be Menachem him, and the Mishnah requires that the skan be to his right. The Rambam says, Hu omeid liyamin Kohen Gadol tamid. Maybe the Rambam extrapolated from the Mishnah that the Mishnah is not telling me a bezunah or a separate halacha in Nichum Avelim, but in general, as far as the kavod that we have to give the Kohen Gadol, the skan always has to be on his right. The Rambam adds, V'zel kavod lo, V'chol akonim mitachas yan hasgan. And the rest of the kohenim are underneath the hand of the skan. Okay, we'll see later on what that means. Okay, as far as the melech is concerned, in contrast with the Kohen Gadol, lo don, v'lo donin oso. He does not judge, even though he's a great scholar, and he does not stand trial to be judged by others. The Gemara is going to derive this from Sukkim. Lo meid, v'lo meidin oso. He doesn't testify, and he cannot be testified against. They can't testify against him. Now, the Gemara is going to ask, why did the Mishnah have to bother telling me v'lo me'idin oso? If you're telling me lo donin oso, then obviously ain me'idin oso. He's never on trial, so why would there be two eidim to testify against him if he's not standing on trial at all? So this has something to do with the structure, the literary structure of the Mishnah. The Mishnah always tries to set up a kind of a symmetry, correct? A symmetry. So that's the subject of this long Tosfos here, Kohen Gadol. Now the Mishnah says the following. What's the story of the Melech with regard to Yibum and Chalitza? Now, technically, if the brother of the Melech dies without children, there's no reason why the laws of Yibum shouldn't apply here, because there's no Iser for a Melech to marry an Almana. So the Mishnah is going to say Lo Miyaben. That's coming a little bit later in the Mishnah. And it seems that the nature of Yibum itself is to slip into the shoes of your deceased brother, of your late brother. That itself is a bit of a gnai. Meaning, for the Kohen Gadol to say, well, I'm going to marry this woman in order to lahakim shem, lahakim zero liachim hames, with the mitzvah of Yibum, that's a bit of a disgrace. Again, we're going to have to ask the question, what if the Melech on his own volition, Lifnim Ishrus Adin, would want to be Mekayim the Mitzvah of Yibum? Is he totally excluded because that would be a disgrace for his office, meaning the office of the king? Or it's just a p'tur, and it's really his decision. He doesn't have to fulfill the mitzvah, but he certainly could. Now, what about his sister-in-law? If he's not going to be miyabim her, she's not allowed to marry any other person unless she gets chalitza. So the Mishnah says something a little bit shocking. Lo choletz. He's not going to give a chalitza to his sister-in-law Because again, that would be a gnai that he has to come into Bezdin, she spits in front of him. So in this case, she really can't get married to anyone. But don't lose your hope over here, because the Gemara is going to come up with a possible solution to that. V'lo cholzin le'ishto. What happens when the Kohen Gadol himself dies childless? So there's halacha, which the Gemara is going to derive later on, that no one's allowed to marry the woman who is married to the melech. Once he marries her, she's forever and ever asura to any other man. Once again, there's going to be an exception to the rule if there's another king who wants to marry her. But other than that, is therefore lo cholzin li'ishto, so his surviving brother, the brother of the king, will not give chalitza, because chalitza is only done as a matir to allow her to marry someone else. But in this case, she's the widow of the king. No one is allowed to marry the widow of the king. And therefore, we want to avoid chalitza, because, again, the purpose of chalitza, its agenda is to be matir, but she's not allowed to marry anyone. So we leave out the chalitza. V'lo miyabim li'ishto. Just one second, I think I skipped something. Let me read it again. Lo cholets v'lo means he died without children. Oh, now we go back to the case where his brother died without children. Lo miyamen, right? Because we said it was a little bit below his dignity that he has to step into the shoes of his brother. Now, what happens if he dies? So we said in Cholzin, now the Mishnah says v'lo miyabim li'ishto. Okay, that we knew. I mean, we said that lo Cholzin is because lo miyabim li'ishto. No, it's lo miyabim li'ishto. You might have thought that since there's a mitzvah of yibum, so it's not like a regular case where, you know, where a Kohen dies, a melech dies, and his wife is not allowed to marry someone else. Here, his wife is getting married in order lahakim shem zero la melech, so to speak. So maybe in this case, the mitzvah of yibum would trump the iser of not marrying the wife, the widow of a kohen gadol. No, the iser to marry against marrying the widow of the kohen gadol is absolutely binding under all circumstances, and it precludes yibum. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Imratzo Lachlots Oliyabem Zachor Latov. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the Melech is exempt from the mitzvah of Yibum if his brother dies childless. But if he volunteers for the job, which would allow this woman, this widow, to marry someone, if he does chalitza, so she's going to spit at the melech, but he's willing to suffer that embarrassment, or he wants to marry her and be mekayim the mitzvah of yibum. So the melech is mekayim the mitzvah of yibum, and now the zera is nikral shem achiv hames. Says Rabbi Yudin, in those cases, tovo lo bracha. He should get a bracha. Why zachar latov? He was mochel on his cover. The Chachamim hold that a melech cannot be mochel on his kavod. But Rabbi Yehuda says no, he could be mochel on his kavod. Amar lo, the Chachamim turn to Rabbi Yehuda and they say, even if he wants to be cholitzo miyabim, ein shomim lo. He cannot be mochel on his kavod. We don't listen to him. Now the Kohen, I'm sorry, I keep saying Kohen when I mean melech, when the melech dies, ein nosin al menoso. No one is allowed to marry the widow of the king. That would be undermining the covenant of the king if somebody marries someone. Which might mean, by the way, that to some extent, whenever an almana gets married, in a certain sense, you know, that marriage is a little bit of a prisas hakavod to the first husband. But that doesn't matter, because your kavod is not relevant. Well, what's relevant here is that your widow wants to get married and she has the right to do so. But when it's a covenant of a melech, that's already a different story.
Jackie Kennedy got remarried, and it was a big uproar that she was getting married.
Yeah.
How long after JFK's?
10 years.
Oh, it's 10 years later. Oh, that's a little bit. Imagine if she got married a week later.
No, it's a while. But it was a big to do.
It was like 10 years.
That she was getting married.
What did her second husband do better than the first?
I mean, he was a super rich man and such, but I mean, people just.
He's a Greek.
But he didn't. He wasn't murdered, at least.
No.
But yeah, there was a big outcry.
And now there's a discussion about who murdered Robin. You know, I don't know if you follow. Oh man, somebody's getting into deep trouble. Anyway. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, you know, the widow of a melech is not lost. No say, a melech, the next king in line, can marry al menaso shel melech. And that's not considered a pagia in the covenant of the melech if his wife is now married off to a king. So maybe if he had a Talmud Chacham, let's say he was married to a woman and he dies, maybe it would not be in any way insulting to him if she married another Talmud Chacham. That happened to my mother, may she rest in peace. After my father died, a few years later, she married another fellow who was quite a Talmud Chacham, my stepfather, if you call him. Unfortunately, he died after 3 years, but he was really a super guy. And Rabbi Yehuda quotes a precedent for this in the Tanakh. She came atzinu b'David she nos al menoso shel Shaul she nemar v'yetno l'cha. Okay, this is Nosan Anovi who's talking to David, and he's saying etno l'cha. God is promising David as Beis Adonov that he will be the replacement king and take over the house of Shaul v'yes neshe Adonecha b'chekecha, and the wives of your master will also rest in your bosom, meaning that you'll be able to marry the almana of Shaul. Do the Chachamim accept this? It would seem yes. That here Rabbi Yehuda is only adding a point. He's not disagreeing with what we had before. And the Gemara later on is going to analyze, would it be that the Chacham would reject this? And if they reject Rabbi Yehuda, and they prohibit anyone, even a melech, from marrying the widow of the king, what are they going to do with this proof from the pasuk by David that David is going to marry the almana of Shaul? That's going to be the Gemara's discussion.